This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Mark. Now here's Pastor Sandy in Mark chapter 5 with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
Jump ahead to verse 42 and you discover that Jairus' daughter was 12 years old. So for the same length of time, 12 years, for the same length of time that Jairus and his daughter had been going on daddy-daughter dates together and had been playing Barbies and had been eating ice cream at Brewster's and dreaming of their future, for those same 12 years, this woman, notice, she's not even named. She's been hemorrhaging and suffering and bleeding. Now, her disease, first of all, had cost her spiritually. An issue of blood like this hemorrhaging, made her ineligible for worship in the temple. She'd been ostracized from worshiping God, even from socializing with the community. And it had also cost her financially. Verse 26 says that she had suffered many things from many physicians. She had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. The doctors were abusing this gal. She had wiped out her 401k. She'd spent all her savings on doctors who failed to relieve her ailment. It's amazing the contrast here. Jairus is a prominent man. This woman isn't even named. Jairus is wealthy. This woman is poor. Jairus is a leader of the synagogue. This woman wasn't even allowed to enter the synagogue. For 12 years, Jairus had lived a merry life. For 12 years, this woman had lived a miserable life. The only commonality they now share is their faith in Jesus. Verse 27. Now when she heard about Jesus, she came behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, if only I may touch his clothes, I shall be made well. This woman believed that one touch of Jesus' robe would heal her. And so she pressed in. She reached up. And with a fistful of faith, she grabbed the hem of his robe. And we're told what happened. Immediately, the fountain of her blood was dried up. She stopped hemorrhaging immediately. And she felt in her body that she was healed of the affliction. She knew it. She knew she'd been healed. Now realize, this woman's faith was actually mixed with superstition. The ancients believed that garments of a holy man contained virtue in and of themselves. That healing would come from the garment itself. Perhaps this was part of her belief. But she also believed in Jesus. And so she looks through her superstition and she has faith. Sometimes faith gets mixed in with other things. He calls this woman out of the crowd. By the way, he's later going to straighten out her superstition. But for the moment, he calls this woman out of the crowd. And Jesus immediately, knowing in himself that power had gone out of him, he knew what had happened too. He turned around in the crowd and he said, who touched my clothes? But his disciples said to him, you see the multitude thronging you and you say, who touched me? Hundreds of people were around. A whole crowd of people were touching. They were pressing and pawing over Jesus. Yet here's a wonderful truth. Don't miss this. The love of Jesus is so personal. It's so intimate. Understand, his love is tailored for each one of us. Here's a great quote. He loves each one of us as if there were only one of us to love. This is our Lord. This woman is never named, but Jesus knew her name. He loved her with a special and with a specific love. It's interesting. Though she was anonymous when she touched Jesus and was healed, he refused to let her remain anonymous. For he now calls her out of the crowd. Jesus challenges this woman to go public with her faith. As in fact, even today, he wants secret saints to become public witnesses. God's forgiveness, like this woman's healing, costs us nothing. But once we receive it, Jesus wants us as recipients to step out and to stand up for what he's done. And so verse 32 tells us, Jesus looked around to see her who had done this thing. But the woman, fearing and trembling, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And this is where Jesus explains to her that the healing wasn't due to his robe, but to her faith. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well." It's no superstition. Your faith is what did it. That's what made you well. "Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." The key was her faith. Today, if you're miserable, if you've wasted time and money and energy on silly cures, if you've been looking for answers in all the wrong places, reach out to Jesus with a fistful of faith. Touch the hem of his garment, and your bleeding will stop. But in that same moment, while Jesus was still speaking, some came from the ruler of the synagogue's house and said, "Oh, your daughter's dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" Again, notice the contrast here. In an instant, the woman's 12 years of misery turns into joy, while a girl's 12 years of joy suddenly turns into grief. And life is like that, isn't it? You never know what a day might bring. Life is full of surprising twists and turns. Verse 36, "Well, as soon as Jesus heard the word that was spoken, he said to the ruler of the synagogue, 'Do not be afraid, only believe.' And he permitted no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. Then he came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue and saw a tumult and those who wept and wailed loudly." Now realize, the Jews hired professional mourners to weep and wail over their dead. They wanted to create an expression of grief. There were professionals who did this service for you. History tells us that even the poorest family would hire two minstrels, two flautists, and one screamer. Jairus was a wealthy man, so he probably hired more than that, understand. When Jesus came in, he said to them, "Why make this commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." You know, sleep is the word used in 1 Corinthians 15 to describe the bodies of those Christians waiting for the resurrection. You know, at death, our spirit goes to be with Jesus, whereas our bodies occupy the grave. In essence, our bodies are asleep waiting for Jesus to return and resurrect us and reunite us with our spirits. Of course, these mourners were familiar with death. And in their minds, this little girl was a goner. Thus, in verse 40, they ridiculed him. Imagine that. They laughed at the King of Kings. They mocked the resurrection and the life. Jesus is going to get the last laugh, trust me. "But when he had put them all outside, he took the father and the mother of the child and those who were with him and entered where the child was lying." Now, I want you to notice this. It's so important. Before Jesus works a miracle, he first puts out the mockers. Before Jesus works a miracle, he first puts out the mockers. Now, sometimes the mockers are cynical people around you. At other times, the mockers are our own cynical, negative, doubting thoughts. But Jesus shows that miracles most often happen in the atmosphere of faith and praise. You've got to put out the mockers if you want a miracle. Miracles happen once you get rid of the mockers. "Then Jesus took the child by the hand and said to her, 'Talitha kumai,' which is translated, 'Little girl, I say to you, arise.' And immediately the girl arose and walked, for she was 12 years of age, and they were overcome with great amazement." Even death was a minor technicality for Jesus. And if Jesus can raise the dead, let's believe him for the miracle you need tonight. What do you say? Verse 43. "But Jesus commanded them strictly that no one should know it, and said that something should be given her to eat." And I love this combination. This is so cool. Even a miracle doesn't replace a need for a bowl of chicken noodle soup. Little girl still needs some food on her stomach. So he said, give her something to eat. And notice the near impossible command. You know the real miracle in this thing would have been for them to really keep their mouth shut, not tell anybody about this. I mean, this is like an impossible command Jesus gives them. Tell no one. Are you kidding me? My little girl, my princess has been resurrected from the dead, and I'm supposed to sit on this? You got to be kidding. We're going to find out Jesus was concerned about crowd control. This was a real problem for him at this point. People were crowding around him. This was dangerous. And that's why he wanted them to downplay his miracles rather than headline them. It was only increasing the crowds. Which brings us to chapter 6. Then he went out from there and came to his own country, and his disciples followed him. Now, it's a 22-mile walk from Capernaum down to Nazareth. But it's always downhill when you're headed home. The last few months had been a whirlwind of busyness for Jesus. His newfound notoriety had been stressful. Crowds were coming all around him. He was attracting the masses. I'm sure he was excited about a break. He wanted to spend some time hanging out with his brothers, maybe see his mom. And especially he wanted to worship in the synagogue in which he had been raised. And when the synagogue had come, and when the Sabbath had come, he began to teach in the synagogue. Of course, they asked Jesus to do the teaching that Sabbath. Everyone wanted to know his intentions. Who did he really claim to be? And many who were hearing him were astonished, saying, "Where did this man get these things?" Jesus impressed them with his wisdom and his command of the scriptures. "And what wisdom is this which is given to him that such mighty works are performed by his hands? Is this not the carpenter?" Tecton is the word. It's the root word from which we get our word technical. This is the Greek term here translated carpenter. See, a tecton was a technical carpenter. In contrast to framing houses, the tecton made furniture or tools. He was a detailed craftsman. This is what Jesus was. There's a legend that says that Jesus, his specialty was wooden yokes. A wooden harness had to be an exact fit, or it would rub or irritate the animal. This added meaning to Jesus' words, "My yoke is easy." The legend has it that a sign hung over Jesus' carpenter shop. It read, "The best fitting yokes made here." The yokes Jesus crafted were perfect fits, and they still are. You know, when Jesus asks you to climb into his harness and submit your life to his will, it is a perfect fit. What he calls you to do, you find he's already equipped you to do. Along with the task comes a love for that task. If today you're under a heavy burden, it didn't come from Jesus. Maybe the people around you, but not Jesus. His burden is light. His yoke is easy. But they not only called Jesus the carpenter, notice they called him the son of Mary. And this was an insult, not a compliment. In ancient Israel, men were referred to by their patriarch's name. Even if the father was deceased, they were the son of their father. But here they call Jesus the son of Mary. In doing so, they were questioning his parentage. Remember, this is Jesus' hometown. And the hometown crowd remembered the scandal surrounding his birth, that Mary had turned up pregnant before her marriage to Joseph. And few people in town believed her explanation of a miracle. By calling Jesus the son of Mary, the Nazarenes were saying, "We don't know who his father was." So they call him the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon, and are not his sisters here with us? Sisters, plural. Now, the Roman Catholics teach that Mary remained a virgin for the rest of her life. They call it her perpetual virginity. I think perpetual fertility is more like it. Because here we learn that after Jesus was born, Mary had a minimum of 6 more kids, 4 boys and at least 2 girls. But here's the point. We're told in verse 3, and they were offended at him. They thought Jesus' claim to be anything more than the neighborhood homeboy was sheer scandalous. They rejected him as the Messiah. See, here's the problem. The men of Nazareth were too proud to acknowledge that one of their own was more than a peer. Oh, we played in the sandbox with this guy. How can he be so special? He's just one of us. See, it's true. Familiarity breeds contempt. The more familiar you are with a person, the more likely he or she is to be taken for granted. Notice verse 4. But Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except in his own country, among his own relatives, and in his own house. What a disappointment this had to be to Jesus. He came home looking for affirmation. Instead, he ended up with rejection. And maybe you've had a similar experience. Your commitment to Jesus has been frowned on by your homeboys. You hoped they would be accepting. Instead, they've rolled their eyes. They've turned up their nose at you. They've been skeptical, if not outright rejected you. Well, at least you're in good company. That's how they treated Jesus. Don't be surprised if it happens to us. As he said, a prophet is not without honor except in his own country. If that's happened to you, you're going to have to re-win their respect another way. Verse 5 is one of the saddest statements in the Bible. Now, he could do no mighty work there except that he laid his hands on a few sick people and healed them. That was a pretty good deal, I would imagine, if you were one of them. But he couldn't do any great miracles there because of their unbelief. Now remember, this was Jesus' own hometown. If he worked a miracle anywhere, I'm sure he wanted it to be here among his own friends and family. But he was limited by what? By their unbelief. Lois Chaney, she writes a probing poem inspired by this episode. Follow along with me. There was a place where the unbelief was so great that Jesus, the Son of God, could not heal and help, and so he left them. Has anyone seen Jesus lately? Has Jesus been seen in your life lately? Friends, he can do amazing works, but the prerequisite is always faith. Verse 6, he marveled because of their unbelief. Two times in Scripture we're told that Jesus marveled. Here at the unbelief of the Nazarenes and in Luke 7 over the faith of a Roman centurion. You remember the centurion believed that Jesus could heal his servant with just a word. Jesus marveled at a Gentile's faith and at the Jew's unbelief. Question is, does he marvel at our faith or the lack thereof? Then he went about the villages in a circuit teaching. First circuit preacher. And he called the 12 to himself and began to send them out two by two and gave them power over unclean spirits. Jesus begins to delegate to his disciples. He can only do so much himself, only go so many places. And so he sends his disciples out two by two, notice. Hey, two by two. It's a good idea. Batman and Robin. Andy and Barney. Mantle and Maris. Starsky and Hutch. God uses dynamic duos. When you serve the Lord, take a pal. One of you can pray while the other one talks. You can watch each other's back. It proves good fruit always comes in pairs. And verse 8, Jesus commanded them to take nothing for their journey except a staff. Now, he's not talking about an assistant pastor here, the CPA or bodyguard or something. It's amazing, some preachers, I get so disgusted. Some preachers think they need an entourage wherever they go. They need a posse to minister somewhere. The staff Jesus is talking about here is a stick, not some pastoral posse. Also, no bag. Don't take a bag. Literally, a beggar's bag. Don't beg for funds. Hey, God's work done God's way will never lack God's support. Where God guides, he provides. You got to trust him. No bread, no copper in their money belts, but to wear sandals and not to put on two tunics. In other words, God's ministers need to travel light and live by faith. They need to be simple. Don't be burdened down with a lot of baggage in the ministry. Also, he said to them, in whatever place you enter a house, stay there till you depart from that place. I love this paraphrase of these verses. It says, Don't think you need a lot of extra equipment for this. You are the equipment. No special appeals for funds. Keep it simple. And no luxury inns. Get a modest place and be content there until you leave. In short, kiss it, man. Keep it simple, saint. Kiss. That's the plan. And whoever will not receive you nor hear you when you depart from there, shake off the dust under your feet as a testimony against them. If somebody rejects you, hey, if somebody at your office rejects you, your neighbor rejects you, hey, forget it, move on. Don't stand around feeling sorry for yourself while other folks need to be saved. Don't get bogged down in bitterness. Wipe the dust off your souls and move on to other souls. God will deal with the resistors. Assuredly, I say to you, it will be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city. So they went out and preached that people should repent. And they cast out many demons and anointed with oil many who were sick and healed them. His disciples were now empowered by Jesus. Now King Herod heard of Jesus, for his name had become well known. This Herod was Herod Antipas, son of Herod the Great, the one who murdered the children of Bethlehem. He said, John the Baptist is risen from the dead, and therefore these powers are at work in him. I'm sure this was his guilty conscience speaking. Antipas was complicit in the Baptist's murder. We're going to read about it in a minute. Others said it is Elijah, and others said it is the prophet, or like one of the prophets. But when Herod heard, he said, no, this is John, whom I beheaded. He has been raised from the dead. Remember, Jesus and John were cousins, and tradition says they had a striking resemblance. Herod here is haunted by John's memory, this man that he's murdered. Now, it's interesting, this Herod, he had wealth, he had power, he had luxury, but he was tormented. He was tortured by a guilty conscience. It's been said, a guilty conscience is the part of you that hurts when everything else feels good. A condemned conscience prohibits you from enjoying life. It's also been said, a bad conscience has a good memory. And this was always on Herod's mind. The next few verses recall his crime. For Herod himself had sent and laid hold of John and bound him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, for he had married her. For John had said to Herod, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. Now Herod Antipas, this was a seedy, immoral man. On a visit to Rome, he had fallen in love with his half-brother's wife, Herodias. He divorced his own wife and he stole Herodias from his brother. By the way, she was not only his sister-in-law, she was also his niece. So add this all up and the king was guilty of divorce, adultery, and incest. Herod had turned Israel's royal family into a soap opera. But John here calls him on the carpet. John was fearless. Intimidated by no one, John took on this ruthless king. He said, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. And he must have said it in a very public fashion. Therefore, Herodias held it against him and wanted to kill him. But she could not, for Herod feared John, knowing that he was a just and holy man, and he protected him. And when he heard him, he did many things and heard him gladly. Now, in his own warped way, King Herod respected John the Baptist. Understand, this Herod was a politician. He based his decisions on the latest opinion poll. In contrast, John had integrity. These two men couldn't have been more opposite. And yet, despite Herod's admiration of John, Herodias hated the Baptist with a vengeance. She was a wicked, wily king who didn't like being publicly rebuked. Then an opportune day came when Herod, on his birthday, gave a feast for his nobles, the high officers, and the chief men of Galilee.
Thanks for listening to Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams. Today, Pastor Sandy covered more ground in the Gospel of Mark. As you listen, read, and learn from these passages, our hope is that you sense the heart of Jesus as he interacted with people. He had compassion when healing a leper. He also had compassion for crowds of hungry people when he fed the 5,000, and also the account of feeding the 4,000. Compassion. It can be something that you don't experience much of in the world these days. Between media and political disagreements, there can tend to be very little compassion for human beings. But Jesus wasn't this way. He expressed a love, a care, and a concern for fellow mankind. Think about some ways that you could show compassion to someone today. Maybe there's a homeless person on the corner who's just asking for a little food or a drink. Someone you know may be suffering from a chronic illness and just needs someone to pray with them. These are the ways of Jesus talked about in the book of Mark. Sandy Adams Radio is a ministry of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. To hear more teachings, visit sandyadams.org. An even better way to connect with us is to join us for one of our services. We have Sunday services at 9:15 and 11:15 a.m. We look forward to seeing you then and also for the next edition of Sandy Adams Radio.